Some of you have heard the topic of this Dhamma talk before, but it is like so much of the Dhamma, it's well worth repeating, well worth hearing again and again. This is a selection out of the last chapter of the Sutta Nipata, the Far Shore. Is anyone strongly familiar with that chapter? Anyone made a study of it? The Far Shore?
What was the name of the chapter?
They call the chapter The Far Shore. Let me see what it might be in Pali. Yeah, I think it's the Parahyanavaga. The 16 Brahmins questions. This one came to my attention in part because it's one that a great lay woman disciple was said to have recited every day, I believe every morning. She's one of the great lay disciples that the Buddha said for all women lay disciples to be like. He mentioned that the monk should be like Mahamoggallana, Venerable Sariputta Mahamoggallana, that bhikkhuni should be like Venerable Khema and Venerable Uggalavana, laymen should be like Citta and Hattaka Alavaka, whose background story Bhante mentioned a little bit last night. And lay women should be like Uhuduttara and Nandaka Mata. We don't know an awful lot about these two lay women that he said for all the female lay disciples to be like. But one quality that jumps out from the scriptures and commentaries when they're mentioned is that they were learned. And this particular set of teachings was reportedly recited every day by one of them. Bhante Gunaratana one time mentioned that although some of the material in the Sutta Nipata is known as being late, that particular chapter is not, and actually it's referred to in a number of places in the canon, so it existed within the Buddha's lifetime for sure, and he referred to it as some of the deepest teachings that we have. And it comes with a very wonderful story. It's set within a really great story. Once there was a Brahmin who left Savatthi and went down a southern road and took up residence beside the river Godavari. And he stayed there for many years. He became a very great, respected elder Brahmin. He wanted complete simplicity. He wanted a life of virtue and goodness. He was a very good renunciate. He was a Brahmin practitioner, meditator, ascetic type with the antelope hide and so forth. And he had many students who themselves were great masters. So he was very, very learned, very highly respected. He received such a great quantity of gifts at one time that he held a great sacrifice and distributed everything in the course of that sacrificial ritual. And then after this had been done, he had just gotten back to his hut when another Brahmin arrived. So he was a dirty fellow. He was had swollen feet and dirty teeth, and came up to this elder Brahmin and said, "Give me 500 pieces of money." And the elder, his name was Bhavari said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You see, look around here. I live so poorly. I have nothing. I kept nothing from the great sacrifice." And this guy said, "You're a liar. Give it to me." He said, "No, I have nothing to give you. Please forgive me. I have nothing. You know, come in, take a seat, have some refreshment, but I have no money to give you." And the fellow said, "You're lying, and may your head split into 7 pieces in 7 days." And he did a whole ritual and a curse on the good elder Brahmin that his head would split into 7 pieces in 7 days. The elder Brahmin was very, very distressed by this. He stopped eating. He started looking very sick. It it stressed him, it worried him terribly that his head might actually split from this guy's curse in 7 days. A goddess who was an old friend of his came to him, not that he knew her in this life, but from a past life, came to him out of concern for him. And she said to him, he was only an impostor, that man, trying to make easy money. Besides, he was ignorant. He knows nothing about the head and the splitting of the head. Bhavri was very amazed. You know, here's this goddess at his hut, comforting him and telling him this. And he said to her, goddess, if he doesn't know, then who does? If you understand head splitting, then please tell me all about it. I have to understand. She said, no, I don't know about it either. But there's someone who does. So you must tell me who in the world I can go to who will know. And she said, in the line of the great king Okaka, a boy has been born to the Sakyas. He has gone out of their capital, Kapilavatthu. He has gone into the world as a leader and a light. This man, Brahman, has total enlightenment. This man has total perfection. This man has the power of total knowledge, the eye of total vision. He has found the total ending. He has lost the basic grasping and is free. He is enlightenment. He's a Buddha. He's a Lord, a master of blessings for the world. He has the eye of vision, and he teaches the way things are. Go to him and ask your questions. He will explain it all. When Bhavri heard the word Sambuddha, the name for total enlightenment, he was lifted to the heights of joy. We hear in some other accounts of educated Brahmins hearing the word Buddha and their hair standing on end. What, an awakened one? I'm told that the word Buddha means to awaken, that even in India today, if somebody is sleeping late, a family member may shake him by the shoulder and say, Buddha, 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 you know, wake up, wake up, wake up. It's awakened. When he hears this word, usually reserved for something very extraordinary, he's just, you know, astounded and very deeply moved. Not only him, some other people had that kind of response. Anathapindika, when he heard the word, he became very eager to see the Buddha, so agitated he couldn't even sleep that night, and went off to see him in the dark before dawn, taking a great risk in doing that, just because he was so deeply moved by the idea. As his sorrow quietened down, Bhavri felt immense delight take him over. The gladness and joy made him eager and deeply thrilled. Where, he asked the goddess, does this world guide live? Which village is he in? Which town? Which state? Let's go and honor this man, this ultimate being. The conqueror lives in Savati in Kosala, said the goddess. The Sakyan is a wealth of wisdom and a world of knowledge. He's unharnessed and undefiled. He has the strength of a hero, of a bull. He's the one to ask about head splitting. But that's a long way for this man. He's old now. He can't make such a journey. He calls his students to him and asks them to go and represent him and meet the Buddha and ask his question. So he called his 16 students to him. And their names are remembered. This version does not have it all listed. So the 16 gathered together. Each one of them was already a famous master in his own right. They were very dedicated to meditation, very accomplished. They knew the Vedas. They were all of them great, great men. Come here, Brahman students, he said, and listen to this. I have something to tell you. Something has happened, something that rarely takes place in the world. A Sambuddha has arrived. Yes, a man has been born in the world who is now recognized as fully enlightened. Brahmins, you must go immediately to Savatthi to see this perfect being. But Brahman, sir, said the students, how can we go if we don't know what enlightenment looks like? Tell us, sir, how do we recognize the enlightened one? The ancient teachings, said the Brahman, listed each one of the 32 marks of greatness on a superman. When a person is born with these marks on his body, then we can say that one of two things will happen to him. He has two choices open to him and no more. He can choose the life of a layman, the home life, in which case he will conquer the world, not by force, but by virtue. Or he can choose to leave his home, to live as a homeless wanderer, and then he will become a Sambuddha, a man of worth, a fully enlightened, incomparable one. Now, when you think you've found this man, you must ask questions in your mind about my age, my family, the marks on my body, because he had some great marks on himself, my rituals and my pupils, and ask about head splitting too. If he is a Buddha with perfect penetrating vision, then he will answer aloud the questions that you have asked in your minds. As Bhavari taught, his Brahmin students listened. There were 16 of them, all of them famous teachers in their own right. Here they are. Namely, Ajita Tisameteya, Punnaka Metagu, Dodaka Upasiva, Nanda Hemaka Dodeya Kappa, Jataka Nye the Scholar, Badravudha Udaya Posala, Mogaraja the Learned, and the great teacher Pingya the Wise. All of them were there. They were all known, well known as teachers and as men who had found their enjoyment in life through their meditation practice. They were men, it is said, who had not lost the scent of their previous good deeds. They had not lost the scent of their previous good deeds. You know, the Buddha was once asked if there's any scent that goes against the breeze. Of course, we know no, because there's, you know, it's molecules. It doesn't go against the breeze. And the Buddha said, yes, the sweet smell of virtue blows against the breeze. And another time someone asked him, what is the greatest of all perfumes? And he named all these various wonderful perfumes like sandalwood and so forth and said, but the sweet smell of virtue, you know, is better than all of them. They have not lost the scent of their previous good deeds. When Bhavari had finished his instructions to them, they carefully paid their respects and walked past him to his right. With their antelope hide robes and their matted hair, they set off towards the north. They traveled to the land of the Alakas, coming first to Patithana, the Mahusati, Ujjaini, and Gonadha. On they went through Vedisa and Vanasa to Kosambi and Saketa, until they came to the greatest of all cities, Savatthi. That's where the goddess said the Buddha lives, right? But then they continue on. It must be like the situation with the king who met up with the Buddha in the potter's shed. He wasn't actually in Savatthi. From there, they set out again, this time to the land of Magadha. They passed on their way through Setavya, Kapilavatthu, and the town of Kusinara. They went on to the Pava, to the Bhoganagara, the city of wealth, and then to Vesali, where they came to the beautiful Pasanikachetya, the rock temple. This is quite an epic journey they have undertaken to answer their questions in search of truth. It's a wonderful, epic type of story. You have this situation where their teacher has been condemned, perhaps falsely, perhaps by a fake, a rogue. They have this urgency in their hearts to learn truth from a great man, from a Sambuddha, and here they've made this incredible journey. They climbed up the mountain path with the zeal and the haste of a merchant drawn to wealth, or a thirsty man to cool water, or to a man with sunstroke to shade. Have you ever done that? Have you ever had a destination that so called you that even though you may be weary from your efforts up to that point, nothing can stop you. You're going for it. They're just bounding up that mountain to go see the fully enlightened one, the Sambuddha, the rightly self-awakened one. And there, with the order of monks gathered all around him, sat the Lord, the Blessed One. He was explaining the Dhamma to them. The lion was roaring in the jungle. So the Buddha has his order of monks, but it's my understanding that there are many lay people there too, and probably bhikkhunis too. So he has this great crowd around him there. Ajita saw the man of full enlightenment. It was like the sun shining as a ball of fire. It was like the moon bright and a full on the full moon day. He could see all the signs of greatness clearly marked on his body. Astonished and overjoyed, he stood respectfully to one side and silently thought his first question. "Tell me," he asked in his mind, "how old my teacher is. Tell me what his family name is. Tell me how many of the marks of the greatness he has got. And how well versed is he in the Vedic mantras? And how many does he teach?" "He is 120 years old," said the master aloud. Now think of this. The Buddha's sitting there. He's got all his monks and all these people around him. And then he just starts talking. "Oh, he's 120 years old. Well, what's up with this?" "His family name is Bhavari. He has 3 of the body marks. He has the complete knowledge of the 3 Vedas." I was sitting in front of a very admirable elder monk one time who just started talking in a way that he seems inspired here. He was kind of looking up towards the ceiling and just started teaching the Dhamma. And I'm looking around at his students and they're acting like nothing is unusual, but my hair was standing up. And I put my hands in Anjali because that was not just teaching to us. He had something else going on there. It seemed to me that he was as though speaking to somebody that we weren't seeing. That was the impression I had. And boy, it caught my breath and my hands in Anjali and my hair standing on end. And that's what the account of this describes. Everybody could hear the master talking to someone they could not see. Who was asking these questions they couldn't hear? Was it some god, they wondered? Was it Indra, Brahma, or Saka? Who was the master talking to? Astonished, they made Anjali the folded hand gesture in respect. "He has complete knowledge of the 3 Vedas," the Buddha said, "and also the commentaries, the rituals, and the signs. He instructs 500 pupils, and he has reached the ultimate stage according to his teaching. Describe Bhavari's body marks, Master Man, desire cutter," said Ajita silently in his mind, "so that we have no room at all for doubt." "There are his 3 body marks, young man," said the master. "His tongue is large enough to cover his mouth. There's a tuft of hair growing between his eyebrows. And the foreskin completely covers his man organ." Ajita asked another mental question. "Bhavari asked about heads, master, and about how they are split. Please, great teacher, answer this question too." "The head," said the master, "is not understanding. The head is split in pieces and destroyed by understanding, with its army of powers in support, confidence, mindfulness, meditation and determination, energy. These are the powers that split heads." And finally, that was avijja mudhati janahi. So no ignorance as that which is the head. Avijja. Vijja mudhadipatani sadha satid samadhi chandavirya samyutta. So knowledge, wisdom, vijja, is what splits that head. With saddha, confidence or faith, sati, mindfulness, samadhi, which usually was always defined as jhana, right samadhi is defined as jhana, chanda viryena, chanda is like will, application. Determination. Aditana is usually what's translated as determination, so it's, I think, will is better. And virya is energy, power of effort. Now it's very interesting. Think about this. These are the Buddha's words to Brahmin students. Have they been educated in the 4 Satipatthana to know what sati means? Have they heard all of the background to know what samadhi is supposed to mean? It's very interesting. Bhatti Sujato brings out this point in his book on a history of mindfulness, how vipassana, what is the wording? Venerable Nandiya? How vipassana worsted tranquility in the teachings, is that the phrasing, or in Satipatthana Sutta?
Yeah.
How insight worsted jhana in the Satipatthana Sutta. So he points out that this kind of thing that you see again and again when the Buddha was addressing Brahmins who had no knowledge of the Buddha's teachings. He just used these words like sati and samadhi as though they could relate to them, and they could indeed very much relate to them. So his conclusion with that and many, many other reasonings was that actually all of that was known before the Buddha started giving his teaching. It was the entire package of Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path that was special to his teaching, but not those specific ingredients. So again, the head, said the Buddha, said the Master, is ignorance, not understanding, avijja. The head is split in pieces and destroyed by understanding, vijja. With its army of powers and support, confidence, mindfulness, samadhi, and will, energy, these are the powers that split heads. With the thrill of exultation stiffening every pore of his body, the young Brahmin student bared his shoulder from his hide, from his antelope hide, and got down on the ground, threw himself at the feet of the Master. Sir, he said with his head bowed, Lord, seer, Bhavari the Brahmin and all his followers are filled with joy and delight. We have come to offer you honor and reverence here at your feet. The Buddha answered, May Bhavari the Brahmin and all his followers be happy, said the Master. May you too be happy, young man, and may your life be long. For Bhavari, for you, and for all of your group, there are many different doubts and confusions. You now have the opportunity to ask about them. Ask now whatever you want to know. The man of full enlightenment had given Ajita permission, so the Brahmin student respectfully sat down, made Anjali hand gesture, and addressed his first question to the Tathagata, the thus gone one. So the rest of this chapter gives us these questions. Now the story is, it's a very sweet story, but it's not the deep Dhamma that I was talking about. Aside from this idea of the splitting of the head, that's actually quite great. But now we get into the heavy stuff. And it's, I'm not intending to go over all of it. Actually, I'm just going to read you the first question, Ajita's question. So let me back up. All of these 16 Brahmins who so eagerly went to see the Buddha, each one of them gets to ask his question. And according to tradition, with the answering of each question, the one who asked that question attained full enlightenment. The Buddha had such a great skill in addressing exactly what would help that person see the truth clearly in that moment. So as he was answering each question, each of them fully attained except the very last. So now I'm going to read the first one, then I'm going to read a favorite one of mine, and then we'll skip over to what happens as the epilogue to the story. So Ajita's questions. What is it, said Ajita, that smothers the world? What makes the world so hard to see? What would you say pollutes the world? And what threatens it most? It is ignorance which smothers, said the Master. And it is carelessness and greed which make the world invisible. The hunger of desire pollutes the world, and the great source of fear is the pain of suffering. In every direction, said Ajita, the rivers of desire are running. How can we dam them, and what will hold them back? What can we use to close the floodgates? Any river can be stopped with the dam of mindfulness, said the Buddha. I call it the flood stopper. Here we are again at sati. These guys seem to have some idea of what he's talking about. I call it the flood stopper. And with wisdom, you can close the floodgates. Sir, said Adita, where is there wisdom and mindfulness? Where there is wisdom and mindfulness, there is also the hybrid of mind and matter, nama-rupa, the generation of individuality. What brings it all to a halt? So now, this is very interesting to me that he gets the message, okay, what will hold back this, the desire, the rivers of desire? How do you close those floodgates? Mindfulness and wisdom is the answer. This is how you stop these rivers of desire. Okay, but now he's got a further puzzlement here. Well, wait a minute. Does that bring an end to things? But surely there's something still there, even once you have developed mindfulness and wisdom. So he's saying, well, where there is wisdom and mindfulness, there is also nama-rupa. It's there, so what else does he do with this? What brings it all to a halt? This is the answer to your question, Ajita, said the master. Individuality can be brought to a total end by the cessation of consciousness. Sir, said Ajita, there are people here who have mastered all the teachings, and there are students and apprentices and ordinary people too. Tell me how these people should live and work. Let them be like a wanderer, a monk, said the Buddha, mindful and skillful in every way. They should free themselves from pleasure hunger and make their minds calm and undisturbed. Beautiful answer to his question, which satisfied this great Brahmin, Ajita. I'm going to skip over to my personal favorite set of questions. These are the questions by the 11th of the students, Jatukani. Then the Brahmin student Jatukani spoke. I had heard, he said, that there was an ocean crosser, a hero desiring the desireless. And so I have come to ask a question of this man without desire. Tell me this, eye of instant seeing and knowing. What is the state of peace? Please explain it to me as it really is. You, master, rule desire and pleasure like the sun with heat and light rules. Like the sun with heat and light rules and controls the earth. I have only a little understanding, sir, and you are a globe full of wisdom. Tell me how to find and know the way of giving up this world of births and agings. Tell me how to find and know the way of giving up this world of births and agings. The Buddha replied to Jatukani, lose the greed for pleasure. See how letting go of the world is peacefulness. There is nothing that you need to hold on to, and there is nothing that you need push away. Dry up the remains of your past and have nothing for your future. If you do not cling to the present, then you can go from place to place in peace. There is a greed that fixes on the individual body, mind. When that greed has completely gone, then, Brahman, there will be no more inner poison drives, without which, asava, without which you are immune from death. Because of my interest in this particular one, I have collected a number of translations, and each one gives a different sense of the meaning. I'm going to read these. And in this other translation, a shorter version of his question, tell me the state of peace. Tell me as it actually is. Teach me to know the Dhamma, the abandoning here of birth and aging. So this is Venerable Chinisra's translation. Subdue greed for sensual pleasures and see renunciation, nikama, as rest. So rest from exertion is no longer having to try and make effort and, you know, the rat race, the grind, its renunciation is rest, it's peace. Let there be nothing grasped or rejected by you. Burn up what's before and have nothing for after. If you don't grasp at what's in between, you will go about calm. One completely devoid of greed for name and form, Namarupa, Brahman, has no fermentations, no asura, by which he would go under Mara's sway. Ken Norman's translation. Dispel greed for sensual pleasures, Jetukani, said the Blessed One, having seen renunciation, or going forth, as safety. May there be nothing grasped or rejected by you. See, Ken Norman actually gives two different possible translations of some of these phrases. May there be nothing grasped or rejected by you. That is, nothing taken up or laid down by you. Wither away what existed previously. May there be nothing afterwards. If you do not grasp anything in the middle, in the present, or in between, other translations of that. So again, wither away what existed previously. May there be nothing afterwards. If you do not grasp anything in the middle, in the present, or in between, you will wander calmed. That is, you will conduct yourself at peace. Now, that part about removing desire for sensual pleasure, subdue greed for sensual pleasure, dispel greed for sensual pleasure, lose the greed for pleasure, is actually Kamesu Vinaya Geta. We just said that phrase in the Karaniya Metta Sutta. And there it was translated, being freed from all sense desires. Kame suvinaya gayatang he jatugavseyam. What are the last phrases? So that's another way of seeing it, being free from all sense desires. Here's another a translation of part of this. It's not exactly the same, but some of the phrases overlap. Dry out that which is past. Let there be nothing for you in the future. If you do not grasp at anything in the present, you will go about at peace. One who, in regard to this entire mind-body complex, has no cherishing of it as mine, and who does not grieve for what is non-existent, truly suffers no loss in the world. And this is just one that I printed out and posted on the wall of my bedroom years ago, and so I don't any longer know whose translation it was, but I kept that in its footnotes. So dry out that which is past, and here this is defining dry out, viso dehi. Dry out your former karma, make it unproductive by not giving room to passions that may grow of the past. Not giving room to passions that may grow out of the past actions. So dry out that which is past. Don't keep juicing it. Dry it out. Don't juice it. Do you ever have anything in your past that you sit around juicing? Surely some of us have done that. Somebody said an evil word to you earlier that day. Maybe they said an evil word to you 10 years ago. Maybe a family member did. That evil cousin, that drunken uncle, they did or said something. And you're sitting around and you were peaceful, but suddenly you remember that and you get angry. You get agitated or irritated. Think of all the things you should have said or done back then to get even. Renew your vow never to speak to that person or whatever. Juicing your past. For what? For ill will or passion or trouble now. Dry it up. Or maybe somebody said something yesterday. Something really unskillful. Should not have been said. Are you juicing it still? Well, even 5 minutes ago was past, isn't it? Are you ready to dry it up? Am I ready to dry it up? This is why it's my favorite one. I'm not there. You know, this is favorite because it's right where right where my practice needs to be. And what other things should we dry up of our past? What about the things that make us, think how wonderful this was. Oh, that, you know, I used to go to that ice cream shop that was not far from the house, and I used to get the most wonderful ice cream sundae, and it was just right, and just this chocolate and the cherry on top, and it. Have you dried up your past? Are you still choosing it? Dry out that which is past. Let there be nothing for you in the future. And footnote, do not rouse karma productive passions concerning the future. Oh, we do the same thing with that, don't we? How much nonsense do we manage to subject ourselves to regarding things that have not happened, that we think may happen? How much fear do we stir up? How much anxiety? How much outrage? Because you just know they're going to do this and that. And what's really bad is when they do this and that, and then you predict it, and then you just want to slam them. Or you think about how you will get to see again that loved one. Isn't that desiring something of the future? You think of their goodness and their beauty and their sweetness and their trust, and you generate all of these passions for the sound of their voice, the sight of their face, the gentle touch, their scent, the comfort of a place that you want to go to again. But there'd be nothing for your future. You know, you think these cottages are bare, but what about a future in which we weren't grasping for anything? A future that we're not like hanging on to as being something settled, that we want this and that from it. You think these little cottages are empty? That's pretty darn bare. Now that is some serious renunciation, to renounce the idea of getting this and that in the future. You know, they say arahants are not even capable of storing up something for themselves. It's amazing to me. Not even capable. If you do not grasp at anything in the present, you will go about at peace. I have one more translation, which is my personal favorite of the various phrases cobbled together. If you would dispel, be free from all sense desires, jatukani, having seen nikama, renunciation, as safety, as rest, don't grasp or reject anything. Dry up the past, don't have anything for future. You will grasp nothing in the middle. Supremely calm, you will walk. I wonder if that kind of phrasing might be an origin of go in peace. To walk supremely calmly. Go in peace. All greed in, on, or at nama rupa, mind and form, gone. So all greed in, on, or at namarupa, gone. Then Brahman, no asava, no taints, outflows, live. Then Brahman, no asava, live, without which you are free from death. Again, if you would dispel, be free from all sense pleasures, jatukani, having seen nikama, as safety, as rest, don't grasp or reject anything. Dry up the past. Don't have anything for future. You will grasp nothing in the middle. Supremely calm, you will walk. You will go in peace. All greed in, on, or at nama rupa, gone. Then Brahman, no asava, live, without which you are free from death. Don't grasp or reject anything? Don't grasp or reject anything? Oh, boy.
Are we allowed to ask questions?
Better to the safe to the end. Thank you. It's a very high standard. Now, when people are going about their lives, and this is not like a practical teaching for practical, ordinary lay life. This is a teaching for someone who is trying to put themselves on a trajectory to take the right steps to create the conditions that will lead the mind completely out of suffering. It's a very high level of practice. And you've got to get certain things in order before you're in a position where you're going to effectively be not grasping or rejecting anything. If you try to take on that attitude and work a 9-to-5 job, I don't think it's going to work very well. But if you could get into a situation where all you need to worry about is, you know, walking in the morning for your alms and go do your meditation, then this is good advice. All you have to do is, you know, just maybe do a little bit of the monastery tasks and attend to your meditation practice. And this becomes, this kind of instruction becomes more doable. If you're living a very busy life and you have many obligations and many duties and people depending on you, you really have to work hard to maintain the structure that allows you to have a certain amount of comfort and freedom. If you give up that structure, you'll be in disaster. So this is not a teaching geared for just getting started in your meditation in your Buddhist practice, or for typical situations of my life. Continuing with our story. So he was the 11th. And the Venerable Pingya, that elder, let's go to his question, the 16th of them. Then the Brahmin Pingya spoke, "I am old and decaying. My body is weak and my skin is pale. I can hardly see and I only hear with difficulty. Don't let me die while I am still in confusion, but teach me about the way things are, so that I shall know how to leave birth and aging behind me." Look, replied the Buddha, "look how many people are tormented by pain. Look how careless they are, and how greatly they suffer because of body and forms. If you do not want to go on and on becoming, Pingya, you must let go of the body and of forms." "In all the 10 directions," said Pingya, "above, below, and in every quarter of the compass, there's not a thing that you have not heard, seen, known, or understood. Teach me about the way things are, so that I shall know how to leave birth and aging behind me." "Can you see," replied the Buddha, "how people are oppressed by desire? Can you see how they are racked and worn by aging? If you do not want to go on and on becoming, Pingya, you must let go of craving." So Pingya has a certain level of understanding from this, but he doesn't make the full breakthrough. Now, this next part, some say, was all added on later. I choose not to believe that. This is what the master said when the 16 Brahmins came to the rock temple in Magadha to ask him to answer their questions. "If one knows what each question means, sees what each question implies, and lives in accordance with the way things are, then they will go beyond. You will cross the ocean of death and aging and reach the other shore. These things lead to that other shore. That is why this teaching is called Parayana, the way to the beyond, or the far shore." You know, just by the way, our friends Bhante Jag and Aya Opeka are starting a forest monastery, and they were thinking about, you know, names for the monastery, and they were very interested in the idea of Parayana, the far shore, but they were a little concerned about jokes around the far side. So I think they gave up that idea. There were 16 of them who came to see the Buddha that time. There was Ajita, Tisa, Metteya, Bunnaka, Metagu, Dotaka, Upasiva, Nanda, and Hemaka, Todeya, Kappa, and Jadukani, the scholar. But Dharavadu Bhadravuta, Udaya, Pusala, Mokaraja, the learned, and the great Pingya, the wise. These were the men who came to see the Buddha, the man of perfect action. They came to the Buddha to put their complex questions to this paragon of understanding. The Buddha answered their questions with the exactness of truth, just as things are. The Brahmins were pleased to hear the words of this wise man. And so, filled with pleasure by the clear-sighted vision of this kinsman of the sun, it's one of the phrases, the epithets of the Buddha, the kinsman of the sun. Adicca, sometimes used synonymously with more common word is Surya. Oh, I see. It's actually Adicca Bandhu, kinsman of the sun. So Adicca would be sun, and Bandhu is like relative. Adicca Bandhu, the relative of the sun, because he's so brilliant, so bright. And so, filled with pleasure by the clear-sighted vision of this relative of the sun, they settled down to a life of purity and goodness, spent in the shelter of the precious wisdom of the Buddha. Anyone whose life accords with what the Buddha taught in these answers goes across the ocean, from here to the beyond, from this shore to the other. This is crossing the ocean. This is traveling on the highest path. It is a path that leads to that other shore. That is why it is called Parayana, the way to the beyond. I will sing you the praises of the way to the beyond, said Pingya, when he returned to where the Brahmin Bhavari lives on the banks of the river Godavari. It was described to us by this man exactly as he saw it. But then there isn't any reason why a man like him should lie, a mammoth of knowledge and completely pure, a man without desire. When a voice has none of the glibness of pride and none of the ingrained stains of ignorance, then its words are full of sweetness and beauty. It is such words that I praise now. They call him Buddha, enlightened, awake, dissolving darkness with total vision, and knowing the world to its ends. He has gone beyond the states of being and becoming. He has no inner poison drives, no asava. He is the total elimination of suffering. This man, Brahmin Bhavari, is the man I follow. Now, he used to be Bhavari's student. He left Bhavari as a student, and he comes back a student of the Buddha and announces this to Bhavari. But I don't think Bhavari is upset. I think he's actually very delighted to hear that it's true, that it's real. He really is a Sambuddha. This man, Brahmin Bhavari, is the man I follow. It is like a bird that leaves the bushes of the scrubland and flies to the fruit trees of the forest. Bhavari, you were scrubland. Now I've gone to the great forest. I too have left the bleary half-light of opinions. Like a swan, I have reached a great lake. Up till now, before I heard Gotama's teaching, people had always told me, this is how it has always been, and this is how it will always be. Only the constant refrain of tradition, a breeding ground for speculation. This prince, this beam of light, Gotama, was the only one who dissolved the darkness. This man, Gotama, is a universe of wisdom and a world of understanding. A teacher whose Dhamma is the way things are. Instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world. But Pingya, said Bhavari, why then don't you spend all your time, your every moment, with this man Gotama, this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose Dhamma is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, and with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world? It's like, how can you possibly have left him? How could you come back here to me when you have such a great teacher out there? Brahmin sir, said Pingya, there is no moment for me, however small, that is spent away from Gotama, from this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose teaching is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world. You see, sir, said Pingya, with constant and careful vigilance, it is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not to my mind a single moment spent away from him. I cannot now move away from the teaching of Gotama. The powers of confidence and joy, of intellect and awareness, hold me there. Whichever way this universe of wisdom goes, it draws me with it. Physically, I cannot move like that. My body is decaying. I am old and weak. But the driving power of purposeful thought propels me with it without break. There was a time when, writhing in the mud of the swamps, I could only drift from one stone to the next. But when I saw the Sambuddha, fully awake and free from defilement, then the Buddha spoke. Yes, the Buddha is back in Magadha. He is here in this other place. But the Buddha, in some way, spoke to him at this point. Pingya, he said, other people have freed themselves by the power of confidence, Saddha. He names, I think, some Brahmins of ancient times. Vakkali, Bhadravuddha, and Alavi Gotama have all done this. You too should let that strength release you. You too will go to the further shore, beyond the draw of death. So the Buddha picks up on what Pingya is saying about this extraordinary connection he has with the Buddha, rooted in his faith in the Buddha. And the Buddha says, stand on that faith and take it to the end. Go for it. These words, said Pingya, are the words of a man of wisdom. As I hear them, I become more confident. He develops more faith. This man is Sambuddha. He has opened the curtains and woken up. There is nothing barren there. His mind is clear and luminous. He knows what he's talking about, in other words. Everything accessible to knowledge is known to him. Even the ultimate subtleties of godhood. There are no more questions for the doubtful who come to him. The teacher has answered them all. Yes, I shall go there. So that faith of his is really coming to full fruition. His faith in the Buddha and, faith that he can do this. The Buddha just said so. I shall go there. I shall go beyond change. I shall go beyond formations. I shall go beyond comparison. There are no more doubts. You may consider this as mind released. He's an arahant now. Anyone got goosebumps? He finishes these words, arahant. There are no more doubts. You may consider this as mind released. This is the introduction to these teachings on the far shore. I encourage everyone to pick up this book and just have a look at all 16 questions and maybe jot them down in a journal and reflect on them, make use of them again and again. Okay.